It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a study at the UW-Madison that's looking to find possible health benefits of the active ingredient in psychedelic mushrooms.
First, state lawmakers are renewing their efforts to pass a bill that would create minimum penalties for drunken drivers who injure others.
The bill passed an assembly committee yesterday. It would set minimum jail sentences from 30 days to up to 3 years, depending on the severity of a person's injuries and whether the drunk driver is a repeat offender.
A similar bill has been introduced to the legislature in the past, was not successful, and lawmakers are unsure if this one will be successful or not.
Joining us now is Bill Leaders. He's covered the state's drunk driving laws for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Well, we've mentioned bills like this one and other tougher drunk driving penalties have been introduced in the past. Why didn't it work out?
Well, this exact provision, this would toughen the penalties for individuals who injure others while driving drunk. There's different levels of increased penalty, whether the person is seriously injured, whether it's a first offense drunk driver or someone who's a repeat offender, but it would prescribe tougher mandatory minimums for drivers who injure others while they're drunk. This was one of a number of bills that was also introduced in the last session. This particular bill that would do something very similar to this did also receive a favorable committee vote, which is what happened yesterday with this bill. After it received that vote, though, it just died in its tracks. It was never brought up for a vote in either house. And that was also the fate of a number of other bills in the last session that would have toughened drunk driving penalties in a number of ways.
Now, this was passed by Republicans, a unanimous Republican vote in that committee. Democrats opposed for reasons we can get into in a bit. But this is a case where Republican lawmakers pass a plan in the committee, and then the Republican legislature as a whole doesn't pass it. Does it never even come to a vote in many cases?
Well, I think the issue is that the Republicans on the committee voted for it this time and last time. What happened last time was that the Republican leadership did not see fit to, bring this up for a vote. That was a decision probably made at the leadership level, Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald was the main player on that. Now, I interviewed him on his reasoning on these things, and his thought was that, the state had achieved significant reductions in the incidence of drunk driving and in drunk driving injuries and fatalities, and that he thought that maybe treatment was a better option, something that would be a smarter way to go than just toughening penalties. Now, another factor that comes into play on these things is, when you increase penalties, you potentially increase costs. And a number of the bills in the last session, had these, enormous price tags attached to it. If we do this, oh, my God, we'd have to build new prisons. We're going to incur hundreds of millions of dollars of additional expenses. People disputed that, saying, well, it also could mean that fewer people would be driving drunk and we would, reduce some of these costs. But anyway, cost is another factor that comes into play. For the bill that passed yesterday about the injury thing, it's estimated it would cost about $500,000 in additional enforcement costs.
Talking to Bill Leaders from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, looking at a new effort to toughen drunk driving penalties when drunk drivers injure or kill others in an accident. Bill, there's a perception, maybe a reality, that Wisconsin's drunk driving laws aren't as tough as most other states, any other states. Is that perception a reality?
Well, it's certainly true that Wisconsin is the only state in the country where first offense drunk driving is not a crime. It's still a civil offense. So the penalties are significant, but it's not a crime. It's a civil a violation. There are other ways in which other states have done things that have not happened in Wisconsin. Some of these proposals, would make our laws tougher, like other states have done. But there are certain other things that nobody has even suggested that we do in the state of Wisconsin that have worked well in other states, like sobriety checkpoints have a demonstrated record of effectiveness, but that's not even something that has been proposed in this current session, so far as I know. Certainly it wouldn't go anywhere. The mandatory use of interlock ignition devices for anyone who is convicted of a drunk driving offense, that's something that groups like MAV, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, have urged that Wisconsin adopt. That went nowhere in the last legislative session. I don't even see that that's introduced as a bill so far this time around. There's a threshold at which a judge can make you have these interlock devices, but it's, you know, for a second offense or if your first offense is at a high enough blood alcohol content level, it's not imposed in every case in which somebody has committed a drunk driving offense. And that's a proposal that other states have adopted.
Now, a lot of times when a law or legislation fails in the legislature, it goes to a public hearing. There's dramatic testimony. People argue for and against it. Then it gets voted down. These drunk driving laws seem to just fizzle. There's not that much public debate and opposition on it. So why do they not pass?
It's an interesting point. There isn't a lot of opposition. You don't see many groups registering that, you know, we don't want to toughen drunk driving laws. The Tavern League of Wisconsin, which gets blamed for, protecting drunk drivers, I think unfairly, did not register in opposition to most of the bills that were introduced last session. It's registered as neither for or against in terms of this current legislation that we're talking about. There aren't people who come out and say, you know, our laws are tough enough, please don't make them tougher. And yet lawmakers are not inclined to do that. And obviously there is some sensitivity to cost that is part of this equation. And, there just isn't the political will.
Wisconsin, on many measures, ranks number one in drunk driving, and that's the bad kind of number one, worst in the country in many measures. Is there consensus that the state should do something, just not agreement on what that something should be?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're not going to find anyone who would say, we shouldn't do anything to address the problem of drunk driving. There's, you know, a couple hundred people a year who get killed because of drunken drivers in the state of Wisconsin. It's a 100% avoidable occurrence. So, everyone is going to say we should do something. And there's disagreement over it. One of the surprising things that has happened in recent years is the tremendous bipartisan support for the idea of treatment courts for offenders, the idea that rather than just locking people up, that you get them treatment for their substance abuse issues and you try to deal with the problem that way. That's something that Republicans have been willing to spend additional money on, which I think is somewhat surprising to people who think that the only answer of Republicans to a crime-related issue is to make the laws tougher and lock people up longer.
That's interesting that you mention that, because we've seen legislation from Representative John Nygren and others on heroin that's been following a similar trend, moving away from the tough on crime concept to including more treatment in it. Do you see that as part of a bigger change of how we think about drug and alcohol related problems?
Yeah, and it's also part of a bigger change how we're thinking about criminal justice issues. You know, for a while, the only response of the political structure to any sort of crime was, let's lock them up for longer periods of time. Let's be tougher. Let's throw them into solitary and never let them see the light of day. You know, all of these increases in punitiveness have been the only response. And now I think people are stepping back across the board and saying, well, maybe that's not the only solution. Maybe that's not the best solution. Certainly, it's a very costly way of dealing with these issues. Maybe there's a better way to go.
And this legislation that we started out with, the one that just passed an assembly committee, is punitive. That's the main point of it for drunk drivers who injure or kill someone. Do you think that means it's less likely to pass as a result?
Well, it will get opposition from Democrats, I think, and others who will point out that mandatory minimums are one of the factors that are driving our high incarceration rate. And it does take discretion away from judges. Now, I can't sit here and tell you of a scenario where someone could be involved in, driving drunk and injure another person who doesn't deserve some sort of severe penalty under the law. But the fact is that this legislation takes that option completely off the table and says, no matter what the circumstance, no matter how this went out, this person is going to have at least this amount of time in prison as a result of this occurrence. And, you know, that is going to be a controversial thing to do.
Bill, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Bill Leaders talking about the latest effort to pass tougher drunk driving penalties in the Wisconsin legislature. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Since the late 1960s, psilocybin mushrooms have been illegal in the United States due to their hallucinogenic effects on the human mind. But recently, the UW-Madison has been conducting a study on the potential health benefits of psilocybin, the active ingredient in these psychoactive mushrooms.
Joining us now to tell us more about the study are Paul Hudson, principal investigator, and Karen M. Cooper, lead guide and trainer for that study. Paul and Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Paul, let's start with you. What questions do you want to answer with this study? What are you looking to find out?
So this is a study in normal healthy volunteers, and it's a study that's looking at the drug concentrations of the psilocybin in these healthy volunteers as part of a completion of a series of studies that we need to have in our hands as we go to the FDA to try to start a phase three, as we would call it, larger study to evaluate whether or not the psilocybin is going to help patients with incurable cancer with depression and anxiety. New York University and Hopkins have already done two separate studies in a smaller cohort of subjects and have had some really remarkable results. So before we can go on to the larger study, we needed to step back in this normal healthy volunteer group and look at the drug concentrations and just demonstrate that higher concentrations, higher doses were going to be acceptable and safe.
Now, when you're talking about reducing things like anxiety and depression in terminally ill patients using psilocybin or the chemical therein, I mean, what would that look like in these patients? Karen, could you tell us a little bit about that?
What would the anxiety and depression look like?
No, how would the help manifest itself in these patients? What have you seen?
In this particular study, they're healthy volunteers, but we have had reports and there's videos through Johns Hopkins and other organizations that show that they have a sense of peace when they're at end of life compared to before their psilocybin doses. They're able to communicate better with their families, get things done on their bucket list with freedom and instead of fear.
And Paul, walk us through this study. How does it work? Right now, Karen says you're working with healthy volunteers. Mm-hmm. So how does this study process these people and get at what you're looking for?
Well, we are looked for 12 subjects. Today, back at the School of Pharmacy, we're using our last dose, so it's completing today. We have been looking for 12 subjects who had a prior experience with psychedelic drugs, and the reason for that was we were going to be drawing these blood samples over 24 hours, and we wanted to make sure that they didn't have excessive anxiety as we were drawing these blood samples and checking their electrocardiograms. Once we screened them for acceptability, they actually went through 6 to 8 hours of preparation before they got their first dose, and after that, a debriefing session. And each of these sessions is 8 hours. They take it, then they get these blood samples. They stay overnight for some additional blood samples, and then in about a month, they get a second dose higher than the first, and a month later, a third final dose, and that's the highest dose.
And Karen, you are the lead guide. Tell us a little bit about what that means, what your role is in the study.
In the literature, guides may be referred to as psychedelic medicine therapists. In our study, we have people who are trained. We've had about 125 hours worth of clinical training. And the most important thing really is to have a compassionate presence, an ability to really listen and trust in that person's what we call inner healing intelligence, and that the medicine will work with that so that they can get what they need during the session.
And do you stay with them during the time that they're under the effects of the medicine?
Yeah, so we usually have one male and one female, what we call guide, and we do counseling for 6 to 8 hours of preparation. That prepares people for the potential effects of the psilocybin, as well as we do a total life review. We find out whatever we can about them, and this is what we call creating SET. And that's really important and significant compared to psilocybin and other psychedelic use in the recreational setting. And then the guides stay with the person the day that they take the psilocybin for about 8 hours. And by then, the psilocybin is basically out of their system. We meet with them the following morning for 2 hours of what we call integration, so kind of processing their experience and meaning-making from that, and also finding out if they've had any adverse effects or positive benefits from it.
And I don't know how much you can share, but I know in a recent newspaper piece, there was one of the subjects who came and talked about some of his experiences. Could you tell us about some of the feedback that some of these subjects have had based on what they've gone through with you?
So because our study, well, it ends today, but it still is actually ongoing and not published, we do have patient confidentiality issues. But as Jeff Gilpin, the person in the article, shared, it has been pretty profound for people. And these are healthy volunteers who may have discovered they had some underlying issues or anxieties or things that were uncovered, and they were able to take a better look at those under the influence of the psilocybin, even with the blood and urine samples and the other sampling that was going on. They really were able to dive in more deeply. They say it's like 30 years of psychotherapy in 8 hours.
That's a lot. So it's, well, the debriefing then at the end must mean a lot. And in terms of wrapping up this study today, what are the next steps after this, once this is concluded?
It will take about a year, I think, for us to coordinate with the other centers, such as Hopkins and New York University, to try to pull together the study in cancer patients. But our palliative care team here is excited about it. We're looking forward to doing that. In the meantime, in that interim, we're also looking at some pilot studies that might look at anorexia nervosa or opioid addiction. We've been talking to some clinicians about doing some preliminary work to see if, in fact, the psilocybin would be safe and effective in those populations as well.
We're talking right now with Paul Hudson, principal investigator, and Karen M. Cooper, lead guide and trainer for a study at the UW-Madison, looking at the effects of psilocybin on subjects with the eventual goal of using this in people who are terminally ill and what that could provide. And Karen, going back to this study that you've worked on, the setting, it sounds like, is important, the room and what that gives to the people there. Can you tell us a little bit about the place where this all happens?
Sure. Our lab, if you want to call it that, or our setting, is located at the School of Pharmacy at University of Wisconsin currently. And this is a room that's a living room-like setting, I would call it. It's very comfortable. It's safe. It's the place where we do our preparatory sessions with our study volunteers or participants, so that it's a familiar setting. There's a bathroom there. If they feel that they want to have food or snacks, then we can have that usually later in the day. There's a large sofa. We have a great sound system and a standardized 8-hour playlist, so they put on eye shades and headphones to facilitate an inward experience, listen to the music, and just let go and see what happens.
Now, this is something that could, it sounds like, replicate a naturally occurring mystical experience. So is that what you're seeing? Is that the hope, that this might mimic some of what, you know, we might have seen in people who have had these profound, maybe religious or spiritual experiences without psilocybin?
Exactly. The goal is to establish a mystical experience, but often mystical experiences, which not everybody can have, are also not very durable. They may just be moments. It may be a minute or two that they feel that they're in this mystical experience. And the goal of the psilocybin is to establish a more prolonged mystical experience that has, in general, very positive ramifications.
Now, Paul, this kind of research has been a hot-button subject before, and for a while, people were not touching this. You remember, of course, Timothy Leary getting into some hot water back in the 60s. Where are we now? Has all of that culture around this changed? Is this turning around where it is more acceptable, or is it still a little bit controversial?
I think it's going to remain a little bit controversial for people who are not taking a look at the literature. The science that's coming out of major institutions such as New York University, Johns Hopkins University, and now ours as well. UCLA has a report in cancer patients as well. It's really good science. And I think that if people look at the science itself, they're going to find that the studies are being done in a very safe fashion, reproducible fashion, and are really getting some remarkable results. Hopkins, for example, 80% cure rate in tobacco addiction. in a group of 15 people that they had an average of 6 failed attempts to stop smoking. 2 or 3 doses of psilocybin had a 6-month cure rate of 80%. So some really, really remarkable, amazing things. And I think the science is going to be supporting additional additional studies. And let's just hope that we're given that chance.
And when do you expect that patients that you are most interested in with this, people who are terminally ill, might get to be involved in the studies?
Hard to know. It's going to be a function of getting all of the protocols agreed upon, the permissions from the various universities, and also funding. Funding at this point is through private donations. We have an account at the UW Foundation that's had a few donors, but it's met resistance from the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and I don't know at what point it's going to be more openly received. We'll have to see how that goes.
Well, Paul and Karen, thank you so much for joining us and talking today.
Thanks, Veronica.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
That was Paul Hudson, principal investigator, and Karen M. Cooper, lead guide and trainer for the UW-Madison study on the active ingredient in psychoactive mushrooms.
I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. On Tuesday, America's Test Kitchen host Chris Kimball is coming to the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee to give the audience a behind-the-scenes look at the Test Kitchen.
He joins us on this Food Friday for a preview of that live show and to share some of his favorite fall recipes just in time for Halloween.
We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchen? What cooking processes do you want to ask about? And how did America's Test Kitchen help teach you how to cook? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure.
So America's Test Kitchen is going to be live at the Riverside Theater next Tuesday. What is your live show going to be like?
Well, I when I started doing this 18 months ago, I was told, because I hired a director briefly, and they said he said that the audience would be really interested in hearing about me. And I said, I don't really think so. And so we did the first show, and I was right and he was wrong. I took about half the show out the first 2 weeks.
So no one wants to hear about you.
Well, the audience wants to hear about the audience. I mean, the audience wants to participate. They want to ask questions. I make fun of the audience a little bit. They make fun of me. There's a lot of back and forth. We get the people up on the stage. We do a culinary quiz. We do a taste test. Some poor person has to dress up in a Velcro suit and launch themselves on a wall. Don't ask. But it's really about home cooking and all the silly things we do at home and all the silly things we do in the test kitchen. So, you know, we kind of make fun of ourselves, and that makes it a more fun evening for everybody.
What kind of silly things do we do at home that you either need to train us out of or keep in mind when you're, say, putting a recipe out there for us?
Well, yeah, I mean, putting a recipe out there is like, you know, I have 4 kids. It's like kids getting out of college, you know, they go out into the world and you just pray and hope for the best. I mean, that's basically the same thing. Well, I mean, people don't read the bloody recipe. They don't have all the ingredients. I mean, some of my favorite comments are, you know, they're making a Greek dish and the person says, you know, lamb would have really made that dish, but it was a lamb dish. They used meat, you know. Yes, no, in fact, that is the dish. Or the gentleman who substituted shrimp for chicken, you know, and said it was really tough and dry. Well, you cook shrimp for half an hour, that kind of what happened. So, you know, people throw in cream of mushroom soup instead of cream. People don't really follow recipes. So if you're going to create a recipe in a test kitchen, that's great. I mean, fine, but then what? So you have to kind of figure out what they're going to do with it, and that's the harder part.
And in terms of other stuff that home cooks do, and one of the places you zero in on is what we actually have in our kitchen. What do we have in our kitchen that maybe we shouldn't be using, or what should we definitely try to have to cook better meals?
Well, you don't need a lot of stuff. I mean, what you need is a really good 8-inch chef's knife that's sharp, Victorinox, Fortune of Victorinox, Fibrox knife is $40. Great knife, great handle. You need a knife sharpener. You can, for $12, buy an AccuSharp, which is a little manual sharpener, which does a pretty good job. You need a good 12-inch skillet, not nonstick, a regular one. All Clyde makes a good one, of course. They're expensive, but they're good. You need an 8-inch nonstick. You need a 3 or 4 quart saucepan. You need a Dutch oven. You know, and a cutting board that you can throw in the dishwasher. Instant-read thermometer is great. ThermoPen makes an expensive one we love. It's almost $100, but there are others. And a timer. You know, those are sort of the basics. You don't need the sous vide. You know, you don't absolutely need a standing mixer. You can get away without it. You know, you don't need necessarily a pressure cooker, although they do some wonderful things. So I think the more you cook, the less stuff you use, probably.
Now, cooking live, do you get that instant feedback that you don't get when you just put out a recipe in a cookbook or a magazine? Is that part of the fun of doing a live show?
Well, we don't really cook recipes, because if you've ever seen the show where they cook recipes, you kind of want to go out in the alley for a smoke and then come back because it's kind of boring.
Still simmering.
I mean cooking in real time is really boring, I can assure you. That's why TV shows are not in real time. You know, we've compressed the whole thing. So I think what people want to know about is how you do it. And we have two of my favorite videos of all time. One is me trying to burn down the Today Show set, and one is my editorial director trying to do a Bush to Noel with chocolate frosting that had been sitting in the refrigerator for 2 hours, and it was pretty much a train wreck. So, I mean, that's fun, you know. But real cooking, you know, is just not – you can't stand on stage and really cook in real time. This has to be entertainment. And you can't go more than a minute or so without something fun happening, you know, because people are – they pay good money, and you have to give them some energy. You have to give them something to look at, and so we pack as much as we can into those 2 hours.
We're talking to Chris Kimball right now of America's Test Kitchen and Cooks Illustrated Magazine, talking about his upcoming appearance at the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee next Tuesday and what it's like to cook in the home and for people who are going to be trying these recipes. Chris, you just listed a couple of kind of disasters, including cold frosting. Do you still have epic fails in the kitchen, or are you so good at this that it doesn't happen very much anymore and it's a rarity?
No, I think I actually went to make a cake. It was a quick bread, and I think I actually left the flour out. So, now I figured it out before I put it in the oven, but, you know, no, I make mistakes all the time. And so I think the more you cook, the more you know how to fix the mistakes, or you recover from it more quickly. Most of the time I don't, but I get busy, the phone rings, something happens, I skip an ingredient. Skipping an ingredient happens all the time with people, right? I mean,
yeah,
you have 10 or 15 ingredients in a recipe, you know, sometimes you overlook one. Hopefully it's not the baking powder. But then you put something in an oven, it doesn't rise properly, and you have to figure out what to do. If you've seen that happen 30 times, then you have a better chance of fixing it than if you haven't. I think most things are fixable, especially top of the stove cooking. I mean, you can fix almost anything, and just don't panic. So, yeah, I still make mistakes, sure.
Well, Chris, our phone rang while you were talking there, and we have Pat on the line now in Duluth, Minnesota, I think looking for some advice. Pat, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and we love your show both on the TV and the radio. And my question is this. I don't want to use canned beans as much anymore. I'd like to just use dried ones and cook them up. And right now what's happening, I soak them overnight, and too often I'm getting some that are cooked, but then others that are kind of, they're still dryish. And I'm wondering why that's happening, and it's even happened to me with split yellow peas.
Any advice, Chris, from Pat?
Yeah. The question is where you buy them from. There are places to get them online where they're pretty fresh. I mean, they haven't been sitting around for years. I think part of the problem is some of these are so old. They're so dehydrated. And the other thing is when you soak them, sometimes some of them float to the top, and you can probably get rid of those. I would put some salt in the water as well and soak them overnight, which is really helpful because it tenderizes them a little bit so they absorb water better. But it's usually where you're buying them because a lot of those beans have been sitting around a long time. So there are some places online that sell them, and I have much better luck with them. You know, a lot of places in the world like Spain, they actually eat the beans green before they're dried, and they have lots of recipes for stews and things like that. But it's where you buy them. Make sure you salt the water and then discard the ones that float to the top if they're still sitting there.
All right. Good luck, Pat. Hope that helps. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234.
And, Chris, one of the things that surprised me is something that surprised you as well. I read that you said one of the big eye-openers was that searing meat does not sear in the juices. So why does everyone think that it does?
Well, because everyone's been repeating this nonsense for 150 years, even some very famous cooks. What happens is when meat starts to rise, the internal temperature gets to about 110, and two things happen. The meat fibers start to shrink in their length and then in the diameter. And when they shrink around the diameter, it's like squeezing a sponge. Liquid, you know, water essentially comes out. And so that process accelerates. And so at 140 or 150 or 160 internal for beef, for example, you're going to lose a lot of liquid. And it doesn't matter if you've that has nothing to do with what happened to the outside of the steak or the roast. It's not like the outside of the steak or roast is perfectly flat, and somehow by searing it, you've turned it into an impermeable barrier. It's inside. What's going on is that liquid is being pushed out of the meat fibers, between the meat fibers. So searing adds flavor. But searing does absolutely nothing to keep anything inside the meat. It's all about internal temperature. As a matter of fact, you could roast or you could boil meat. And if you boiled a roast to 125 versus roasted it, it would have the same amount of juiciness. It wouldn't affect what's going on inside at all.
We're talking to Chris Kimball from America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Illustrated Magazine. He's coming to the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee next Tuesday. He's with us sharing favorite cooking tips, and we've got a recipe coming up, too.
And we want to hear your favorite cooking tips now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. What questions do you have for Chris about home cooking? What advice do you have for cooking at home? And what advice do you have for someone who's just learning how to cook now? You can call in with your questions, your lingering food mysteries at 800-642-1234. And you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now with Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Illustrated Magazine. He's giving us a preview of his live show in Milwaukee on Tuesday, and he's sharing some of his favorite fall recipes.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question, some advice you need from Chris? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Chris, we mentioned recipes. You sent us, and we've got this on the Central Time Facebook page, a recipe for beef burgundy. We don't need to talk through all the details, but what's the key? What makes this recipe work?
Well, the thing that's annoying about a recipe like this is you have to do a lot of sautéing, you know. And so we took a really hot oven, a little salt pork, some beef scraps, rendered them in a pan, and then reduced the oven down to lower, 325, and then we essentially put all of the vegetables in the meat on the pan and cooked it. So you end up doing this in the oven, and you don't have that problem of multiple batches of browning. Because most French cooking, Northern European cooking, is based upon sautéing heat. And it's just very time-consuming. So this way the oven does almost all the work, and you get some additional flavor from that salt pork in the oven as well. So it's just a really easy way of doing what is usually a pretty complicated recipe.
Right, and that recipe is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Chris, I just want to make sure, I want to do this, but I want to substitute tofu for the beef and like mead for the wine. I can just use the exact recipe, right? I'm just messing with you.
There are no words to describe what I would think about substituting tofu. I mean, I like tofu in its place, but not in beef burgundy. Not as a meat substitute, please. Thank you very much.
Maybe seitan would be a fair substitute.
No, if I try this, I'll try
to I've tried
real
that,
deal.
Too. Yeah. Right. You know, I mean, just go have an apple, please. You
know. All right, let's go to our callers now. We have Karen joining us in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi. So thanks for taking my call, and
sure.
Thank you for you and your staff for inspiring and demystifying some things. I've got a question about using copper cookware. I don't know when to and when not to use it. It seems like it's used a lot when you're whisking eggs, but I don't know why. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Karen.
It's a good question. Yes, copper bowls, unlined copper bowls, were used for whisking egg whites. It helped to denature and stabilize the foam, and that actually is true. But any standing mixer or electric mixer is fine. If you put a little cream of tartar, like a quarter teaspoon, and a tablespoon or two of sugar in with the whites, they stabilize the foam just fine, so you don't need to use copper. Copper pans that are lined usually with tin and now stainless steel are fine. Copper conducts heat very well. But, you know, they're expensive, and you have to keep the outside shiny. And so any multi-ply pan, usually it's stainless steel on the outside and the sandwich inside of aluminum, is just fine. So you don't really need to use copper. It's nice looking, but you can do with all clad style pants fine.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris, it's fall, a lot of good stuff out there. What are some of your favorite things to make this time of year?
Well, I cook more simply now, and I like soups and stews, but doing them a little more easily. For example, I make a lamb soup, which is, just take a pound of lamb and some water, 7 or 8 cups of water, simmer it for 10 or 15 minutes, skim off the top, and then you start adding some beans that you've soaked and some other ingredients, some onions you saute with some cumin, and finally some potatoes. I mean, just very simple one-pot meals. I don't cook, you know, meat and three veg anymore. I tend to make a one-pot thing, maybe with a salad. I think it's not how many things you make, it's which things you make. So I like one pot. I love slow cooker. It forces you to be organized and get things done early in the day, which I like. Matter of fact, we do have a beef burgundy recipe in a slow cooker, which is terrific. I do like that a lot. So I like stews, I like soups, I like things you can just sit in the oven all day. I love pot au feu, which is just beef, which is usually brisket, simmered in water for 3 hours till it's tender and cooked. And then you take the beef out and you simmer some vegetables in it and you're done. I mean, finished. That's probably my easiest favorite meal of all time.
It's apple season right now and a lot of people are cooking with apples. Do you have a favorite variety of apple that you think produces the best results for stuff like apple crisp and apple pie?
Well, if you do have availability of lots of kinds. I love McCowan's. I love Cortland's. I love Rhode Island Greenings. If you don't, usually if you can take half Max and half Granny's. Granny's hold their shape. Max cooked down but have good flavor. That's a good 50-50 combination that always works. In the quote-unquote old days, people would use 4, 5, or 6 different types of apples in their pies. Which I think is nice because some apples are spicy, some are really sweet. I do find a lot of the newer, you know, Fuji, Gala, some of the newer ones are a little too sweet for me. You know, I like them a little tartar. Northern Spy was originally called Northern Pie for a pie apple. They're very good. My advice would be just to get a bunch of different kinds and mix them up. Just try different apples because every apple's different and no apple pie or crisp comes out exactly the same way every time anyway.
Talking to Chris Kimball from America's Test Kitchen. Back to our callers now with Ann in Kenosha. Ann, hi.
Hi. My husband and I are actually coming up to the show next week.
Oh, great.
So
Good.
We're very excited. My question was, since the British baking show has become so popular here, I'd love to see some of those technical challenge recipes tackled by the test kitchen. You know, explain them, explain how to do them, you know, so maybe American cooks could make some of those recipes they've been watching.
And thanks,
yeah, that's a great show, by the way. I really like that show, and it's a really interesting concept. They do a terrific job. Yeah, that's a good idea. We talked about that. That's really my favorite new show in the last few years. It's terrific.
Well, thanks so much for that. And, Chris, any surprises that we should look for? I guess they won't be surprises if you tell us, but what should people look forward to when they come to the show?
Well, I think, you know, we bite back. I mean, we have a lot of questions from the audience. And when you first come in, you're asked to submit a question. We collect them all right before the show. So 10 minutes before the show, I have like 150 questions. So I pick a bunch out to answer in the show. We do a Q&A towards the end of the show. And so there's just a lot of back and forth and in audience participation. So, you know, it's about visiting with the audience visiting with me and us, and it's that back and forth that really makes the show. I did one in Philadelphia last week, and we have a culinary quiz, you know, 10 questions, and you have to hit the buzzer and everything else. Well, the person who lost was really unhappy they lost, and I think they almost got into a fist fight with the winner. So, you know, that's the kind of thing I love, because there's a lot of spontaneity. I mean, not the fist fight, but the, you know, it got kind of tense there at the end. So, that's what I like. I like the unexpected, and sometimes things don't go just the way they're supposed to, and that's the fun part. That's what I look forward to.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, Chris.
My pleasure.
That's Chris Kimball, host of the public television and public radio show America's Test Kitchen. He was with us to talk about his appearance at the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee on Tuesday. Check the Central Time Facebook page for event info and a recipe for beef burgundy. There have been a lot of popular art forms that everyday people have created throughout American history. Quilting, watercolor, scrimshaw. But now the ultimate form of self-expression in these United States is the selfie.
That's right, the selfie. And if you're wondering how to take the ultimate selfie, now there's a bit of science to help out. A computer science graduate from Stanford used a computer network to analyze millions of selfies and came out with a handful of rules for what makes the ideal selfie based on positive responses or likes.
So a few of the rules. First, be a woman. Evidently, the top 100 selfies were all women. Sorry, dudes. Have long hair. Ha! I'm back in the game. Place your face in the top third of the photograph.
And also crop your forehead. You don't want your whole head in the top of your head in the picture. And if you can, use a filter.
There's been some pushback on that cropping your forehead idea. I'm not a big selfie taker. And, you know, if I pull up my phone as a camera and it's pointing the wrong way, I kind of freak out and I see my big face looming there. And I'm like, that doesn't need to exist as a picture.
Can you take a better selfie than Rob?
Probably.
Let us know. You can take your selfie, maybe try to use these rules. You can share your ultimate selfie with us on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Yeah, put your selfie skills to use. Share them online, Central Time Facebook page or Twitter at Central Time WPR.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.